Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Michael Benson is one of today's most popular true crime writers. His books, including Betrayal in Blood, Murder in Connecticut, Killer Twins, The Burn Farm, Mummy Deadliest, A Killer's Touch, Evil Season, Watch Mummy Die, A Knife in the Heart, Escape from Dannemora, Nightmare in Rochester, Haunting Homicides, and The Devil at Genesee Junction, tell vividly of today's most heinous criminals and the clever and stalwart lawmen who bring them to justice. He is currently a regular commentator for two true crime series, Evil Twins and Evil Kin, on the Investigation Discovery ID channel, and also had made guest appearances on that channel's Evil Stepmoms, Deadly Sins, Southern Fried Homicide, and On the Case with Paula Zahn. The Devil at Genesee Junction tells the story of his return to the scene of a childhood trauma. Two of his friends were murdered and mutilated near his rural home south of Rochester, New York, when he was 9. Those murders were never solved. As an adult and veteran true crime writer, Benson teamed up with the mother of one of the victims and a local private investigator to heat up that cold case and propel it in a startling new direction. During his 3 decades as professional writer, Benson has worked closely with a retired Army intelligence agent during the tense days after 9/11, for a book about the CIA, and with a retired FBI agent for a book about national security, co-written 2 books with a former New York Police Department Cop of the Year, explored the grassy knoll in Dallas with a former KGB agent while researching his much-acclaimed Who's Who in the JFK assassination, collaborated efficiently with an astronaut, and covered the Stephen Hayes triple murder trial in New Haven, Connecticut for the New York Post. The episode tonight is Michael Benson, True Crime Retrospective, with my special guest, artist, writer, filmmaker, and true crime author extraordinaire, Michael Benson. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this.
Thanks for having me,
retrospective.
Dan.
Thank you so much. As I was saying, when I looked just to do more research for this after I've had you on. Now, this is the 9th appearance, I believe, covering 9 of your now true crime. It almost looks like there's another Michael Benson, the filmmaker and artist, and because when I mentioned to you, for the audience, when you mention prolific, when you say prolific author, then you have Michael Benson.
Well, there is another Michael Benson. I am not the filmmaker. I'd like to consider myself an artist. But there's another Michael Benson who writes books about planets and satellite photography.
Yes,
and sometimes I'm confused with him. I wrote a book called The Complete Idiot's Guide to NASA. So people tend to confuse us because he also writes about outer space and stuff. But as far as I know, I am the only Michael Benson who writes true crime.
Absolutely. And with what we're talking about tonight, this true crime retrospective, let's talk about how you got involved, where you grew up, and before we talk about something that happened in 1966 that helped shape your career, not that you knew it at the time, you were 9 years old, let's talk about your early life, where you grew up, and before we talk about how you got started in writing, period.
Okay, well, I was born in Rochester, New York, considered to a large extent my hometown, even though I've lived in Brooklyn for a long time. Lived my first 5 years in the city of Rochester. When I was 6, we moved to the town of Chi-Lai. It's spelt like chili, but it's pronounced Chi-Lai, and that's just south of Rochester. Have you ever seen the show Green Acres? I think that was my dad. He wanted to live in the country,
right.
And he had his job in the city. So we moved to the end of a dirt road, as my kids called it when they were visiting Grandma and Grandpa, in the middle of nowhere. It was just a great place for a little kid to grow up. I mean, there were dirt paths everywhere. You'd take a beeline to each other's houses through the woods. We had tree houses, root cellar forts. There was a field of wild strawberries. It smelled great. Come June, you could go out and pick strawberries, come back with a bucket full. We played war, cowboys and Indians. We had a barn. No horses, but the barn was still there. At Black Creek was the northern border of my dad's property, so we'd go fishing, lots of adventures in the woods. But it stopped being idyllic on June 25th, 1966, when something really bad happened.
What happened, and how did it affect this community?
Well, my babysitter, Georgianne Formicola, and her good friend Kathy Bernhardt from down the road had just purchased new bathing suits and wanted to try them out, so they went to a swimming hole behind my house in Black Creek. And the swimming hole was right next to an ancient stone trestle that originally was built for the mules to tug barges on the Genesee Valley Canal. Canal was long gone, and now it took railroad tracks across Black Creek. But there was a nice swimming hole there. And it was a place where police never went. So it was sort of the domain of teenagers. And in the daytime, kids go swimming there. At nighttime, kids go back there, drink beer. And on June 25th, 1966, they went back to go swimming around dusk and never returned. Now, at first, you know, there was a lot of optimistic thinking. Perhaps they just run off. And the mother said, no, that couldn't be the case, because all they had were their bathing suits and a towel. You know, they didn't take their purse, they didn't take their makeup, nothing. So, well, maybe they got picked up by men, and who knows. But the optimism died a couple days after they disappeared, when Kathy's transistor radio, her prized possession, was found broken in the weeds. So it was pretty obvious the girls had been taken by force. So for a month they were missing, and then one day in July, a farmer 2 miles to the west of our property found the remains of the girls in the weeds next to the same railroad tracks, but down the line a ways, and just off of a lover's lane. And they'd been horribly mutilated with a knife, sexually mutilated. Details of which I overheard adults talking about. So, yeah, here I'm a 9-year-old. I don't even know the facts of life yet. And
right.
I'm learning about sex crimes before I'm learning about sex. And it was traumatic, and the whole neighborhood did change. There was a dark cloud came over our area, sort of stayed. No more paths through the woods. Everybody had to stay in their own yard. And it became bleak. And I became obsessed with finding out what happened to those girls, because the case wasn't solved. You know, there was a boogeyman out there, and
right.
Perhaps living nearby. We didn't know who he was. So I grew up to become a true crime writer, and that's not a coincidence. That's I wanted, you know, right from the time I was 12, I started to write about the murders. And I finished the book about the murders 47 years later.
Wow.
Well, a lot happened in between. I went to college. I got a degree, graduated with honors from Hofstra University, degree in journalism, communication arts. And after bouncing around a little bit, I got a job as a magazine editor for the Starlog Group. And during that time, I launched my first adult investigation into those murders. I didn't have a book in mind. I just wanted to know. And what I found was that there was a fellow named Arthur Shawcross.
Sure.
Right. All of your listeners have heard of. And
yes.
He was arrested for killing a series of sex workers in Rochester. And I investigated him and found out that during the summer of 1966, he was 21 years old and was driving around upstate New York looking for places to fish. And this would put him potentially near Black Creek.
Right.
Now, you know, he was having problems with his then wife. He had sexual problems. He kind of misunderstood what affection and consent was all about. He went on to kill two children in Watertown, New York, a few years later. But this was in 1966. He, as far as we know, had never hurt anybody. He was an expert with a knife. He hunted deer and could dress game. He once talked about wanting to kill a doe so that he could use his hunting knife to remove the animal's vagina, which, I mean, is, you know, that sent up a red flag, considering my victims were sexually mutilated. Now, as a young adult, he worked as an apprentice butcher, and he was, I thought, a very good candidate to become the killer of the Chalet girls. But I got in touch with the Monroe County Sheriff, sent a nice letter explaining all my stuff, and they sent a team to the prison to talk to Arthur Shawcross, confronted him with pictures of the Chalet girls, and he closed his eyes, clenched his fists, and put his chin on his chest, which I understand was the same reaction he had when people asked him questions about his mother. So he was given a chance to deny doing it and didn't. And I was told that's about as far as we can go with that. And I realized that in order for me to really do justice to the case in investigation, I needed to know about the original investigation in 1966. And to do that, I needed to have the rights of next of kin, which I didn't have. And life went on. I had a very mediocre career as a sports writer. But every time I had a lunch with a acquisition editor from a publisher, I always told the story of what happened when I was 9 and what a great book I thought it would make. And what happened was Gary Goldstein from Kensington Books gave me a call one day. He says, "You're from Rochester, right?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, there's a murder in Rochester that I really think you should write about. Beautiful young woman was murdered, and her husband and her half-brother have been arrested for the crime." And that's when my official true crime career began. I'd also ghostwritten a book, a true crime book, the year before, which went to number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list, but my name wasn't on it. But people in the industry knew who had actually written it, and that was another reason why Gary gave me a call.
Ah, amazing. Now, you're referring to your book in 2003, Betrayal in Blood?
That's correct, yes. Yeah, it's the story of Tabitha Bryant. She's a pretty 26-year-old mother of two. And she was shot and stabbed to death in her own living room while her husband and two children slept upstairs. It happened July 14th, 2003. It was a hot night. And the book taught me a lesson in human depravity. It turned out that the woman's half-brother killed her in exchange for cocaine money.
Jesus.
The husband wanted the wife killed. And although that's horrible, it kind of happens all the time. The husband's always the number one suspect. But hiring, you know, her brother to do it for him sort of gave it that special edge of depravity that, you know, I think you look for in a successful true murder story. It still astounds me that you know, Cyril Weinbrenner, the brother, would be so addicted to cocaine that his sister would seem dispensable to him in exchange for, you know, a couple of weeks of really doing some good blow. The most important interview I had while doing that book was with the mother, and she's the mother of both the victim and the killer. Right. And she didn't know how to feel. I mean, she was bouncing back and forth. She loved them both. And I asked her if she was going to go to the trial. And she said, no, I can't. I wouldn't know which side of the courtroom to sit on.
Jesus. Wow.
So, but this, so, and anyway, the book did really well. And I immediately got another job. And this time teaming up with a friend of mine named Robert Mladenich, who was a NYPD detective and one-time cop of the year for an unbelievably brave thing he did once. And we met while I was writing for a magazine. It was in my mediocre sports career. I was writing for Bert Sugar's Fight Game magazine, and we were covering heavyweight championship fights. Bob was freelancing for Ring magazine at the time. And we sat next to each other in the corral where the press sits next to the ring. And he told me a story how about he went to Brockport State, which is near Rochester, and he had a friend named Joel Rifkin in college, and they covered fights together. He would write about it, and Joel took photographs. And then Joel dropped out of school, and they lost touch, didn't speak to one another for 20 years. Until Joel was arrested for being a serial killer on Long Island. And here's the old college buddies getting together again. One's a serial killer and one's a homicide detective. So I said, well, that's a pretty good story, but I have one too. And I told him my story when I was 9. And we both agreed that our books deserve to be published. And eventually they both were. That's our first book I did with Bob was Lethal Embrace.
Right.
Yeah, they told us, try to make your titles combine sex and violence. So, Lethal Embrace.
Right.
And the murder took place on January 17th. Yeah, go ahead.
You talk about Lethal Embrace and then teaming up with Robert Mladenich. But in Murder in Connecticut, 2008. This is an extraordinary case. We mentioned it in the – did you cover this for the New York Post? Tell us about this. I mean, if you were hardened by betrayal in blood in that case and then Lethal Embrace, tell us about a little bit about Murder in Connecticut and being involved with that.
Yeah, you know, if I had one regret in my crime writing career – Murder in Connecticut came out too soon. It was the publisher's goal to become the first book out. And this was the case where two creeps in Cheshire, Connecticut, broke into a house, hit the dad, who was a successful physician, over the head with a baseball bat, and then tied him up downstairs, and then proceeded to rob and rape the mom and two daughters upstairs. And then on their way out, they spread gasoline around and lit it, and all three women died horribly. The dad managed to get free himself when he heard screams and made it into the backyard and started to yell. And at that point, somebody called the cops. Somebody saw smoke and called the fire department. And the authorities arrived and captured the guys right away coming out of the house. The two kids, Michaela and Haley, were 11 and 17 at the time. I had two children. They were 11 and 17 at the time. So I took it very personally. And the community was just very distraught. It's an upscale community. Things like that just don't happen there. They were angry. They were a little embarrassed by it. They're just grieving their brains out. It is so sad. And 6 months after the crime, my book Murder in Connecticut comes out, and I'm getting death threats because there are only so many emotions they can feel on the subject, and anger is being focused at me. I had to do radio interviews to defend myself. And the book itself is nothing worthy of a death threat. The crime is described.
No.
But the second half of the book is all about how wonderful the community is and how they rallied around the doctor and just try to be as positive as possible. And then when Stephen Hayes was tried in New Haven, Connecticut for the triple homicide, I was assigned by the New York Post to be their freelancer. And it was just devastating to me. I didn't sleep for days and days and days. I rode up the first day in the elevator with Dr. Pettit. He's a strong, sturdy man. And I can remember very well sitting in the courtroom when they brought Hayes in, and I felt blasted backward by his evil. I mean, it was like a wind of evil hit me and made me recoil. And after a while, that wore off, and I saw him just as a little worm, in the contrast between the worm of a defendant and the huge dad of the representing the victims was just so stark. But probably the worst part was they chose 12 members of the media. And I know it was 12 because they put us in the jury box. Chose 12 members of the media to show the crime scene photos to.
Wow.
So I got to see the poor burned ladies, and was pretty much ready to throw up. I walked out of the courthouse and was grabbed by CBS News. And they put me on the air in that condition. And I've never seen it, but people from all over texted me at the time telling me how great it was. I said, I don't know. I can remember blurting out that, I'm not a big proponent of the death penalty, but I think there's three cases where it's called for. And that's for guys who commit murders in prison who are already serving life, cop killers, and these two bastards.
Yeah.
So the whole thing was just excruciating. If I could do it over again, I would have written the same book, but I would have had it published a year later. They've given that town a little chance to heal before all of a sudden the reporters were back and there were new questions to answer, all regarding me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating how you could get in the crosshairs in there. Just doing some great journalism,
and I knew it was coming too. I said, "Well, what are we going to do when people start yelling at me?" And then the publishers, "No, there's no such thing as bad publicity." Well, okay,
not for him,
they're just going ka-ching. I've never done this for money. I've never taken on a case because I thought it would make the most money. It's always the ones that set a fire inside me somehow, and this one sure did. But it was a mean thing to do to that town, to have the book come out while the wounds were still so raw.
Now you are getting all kinds of experience, especially with this murder in Connecticut, with just the most psychopathic and heinous killers, and then you do the Burn Farm. And Sheila LaBar, tell us a little bit about working on the Burn Farm and not long after that.
It's the only book I ever wrote that got me arrested. We'll get to that. The Burn Farm was by a lady named Sheila LaBar, who as a young woman had a near-death experience. She was in a car accident and was in a coma for a while and woke up convinced that she had gone to heaven. And God had told her that he wasn't ready for her yet. She had a mission.
Right.
And she was to return to Earth and kill all of the pedophiles. And she said that she had been abused as a child, as had her sister, which I believe to be true. And Sheila developed a psychosis she was sort of a nymphomaniacal dominatrix. And she recruited men with mental disabilities to work on her farm. She was recently widowed. Her husband had died under suspicious circumstances, for which there was never any charges. But she was recently widowed. And she brought these men in, and she would start a sexual relationship with them. Then it would become more and more abusive. And unlike, I guess, your ritualized S&M, there were no safe words. She tortured these guys until they admitted that they were pedophiles, even though they probably didn't know what pedophile meant. And then she would kill them, chop them up, and throw them into the bonfire in front of her house, thus making it the Burn Farm. Now, when I went up to, it took place in Epping, New Hampshire, and she lived in a dirt road off of a dirt road. And there was a lady who lived down the road who wanted to write a book about the case herself. And when I contacted her for an interview, she was nasty to me and didn't want to cooperate. And we don't want you people from New York taking our stories and embarrassing us with blah, 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 blah. So I went up there and went to the house where it happened, looked at the pit where they found the bones. And the cop car pulled up, and I walked over, and then the cop, I read his nameplate. I said, "Hello, you're in my book. You're one of the heroes of my book." He explained, "I'm Michael Benson. I'm a writer." And he said, "Well, your opinion of me is about to change because you're under arrest." And I was arrested for criminal trespassing, which was their way of saying, you know, get out of town. But I wrote the book anyway, and I think it's absolutely, you know, one of the most, well, it's, I think we're a little bit more conditioned to think of men as psycho killers. You know, yeah. Female psycho killers, especially when there's sex mixed in, is something new and different. And the book certainly was. You know, I one person who reviewed it on Amazon.com said, "Now, this is the dirtiest book I ever read," which didn't hurt sales at all. But I really wanted to say, but it's not sexy. You know, there's nothing sexy in this book. No. The sex is not sexy. It's horrible. Anyway, so.
It's integral to understand her mindset.
I came out of that one
mindset.
A little bit. Oh, I'm sorry, say that again.
I say it was integral to understand her mindset, to include all of those.
Yes.
Her sexual fantasies in this. It has to be understood.
And juries, as I found out on a number of cases, do not like insanity defenses. They think it's a cop-out. And if you did it, doesn't make a difference how crazy you were when you did it. They're going to say guilty and put you in jail.
Absolutely. Now, I'm not sure of the dates of these releases, but you wrote a book called Killer Twins about just being that, Killer Twins, in 2010. And then also Mummy Deadliest in 2010, apparently. But let's talk about Killer Twins.
Okay.
This is a fascinating case.
Again, another Rochester, New York case, which I loved because I didn't have to stay in a hotel while I was doing my research. I could stay with my mom. And a fellow named Robert Spahalski was arrested in Rochester and charged with 4 murders. And it looked like, you know, there's a serial killer book to be written, but it went off the hook when I found out that he had a twin named Stephen who had also done time for murder. And then when I looked at the two cases, I realized that even though they had spent most of their lives separate because one or the other was in jail all the time, the two male victims involved here, one by Robert, one by Stephen, the killings themselves were near identical. So it becomes this really fascinating story of nature versus nurture. Just a one psycho killer only photocopied into two. You know, it's still a little bit amazing to me. And I, for the first time, and I've used this technique since, I became pen pals with Robert Spahalski, and he told me all about how he became a serial killer. Well, he denied being a serial killer. He thought all 4 incidents were individual.
Okay.
He was a serial killer. He just don't want to admit it. And, but I said, "Well, when did you learn how to kill? And when did you, first thing that pops into my head is, I killed my dad's favorite pig, put a gun to its head, bang, my dad's favorite pig dead." And I said, "Wow, were you mad at your father?" He said, no, I just wanted pork chops that night." So it's a little view into the mind of a guy who has no sense of guilt, a real psychopath. You know, psychopaths think that they have something extra that you don't have. the ability to fight through feeling bad about things. And in reality, they're just missing something. They're missing the whole sense of right and wrong. It's not there. And that really, really fed into my personal knowledge of how psychopaths think, because they don't need much of a reason to kill somebody. Because there's no reason not to. If you think you're going to get away with it, there's no reason not to. If a person's in your way, destroy them. If a person looks at you funny, destroy them. It doesn't have to be anything. Motive to a psychopath is it could be, I killed last week and it was fun, so I'm going to do it again.
I
think they're eventually going to find a genetic component to being a psychopath, but until then, it's as close as we're ever going to come to finding what evil really is.
Absolutely.
And it's always existed because that's the devil. The devil got to Robert Spahalski.
Let's talk about Mummy Deadliest, continuing that theme.
Sure.
Of psychopathy.
Well, yeah. If you watched 2020 last Friday, I was on talking about this case.
Yes.
And it was recently a movie on Lifetime. And it's about a woman named Stacey Castor who poisoned both of her husbands using antifreeze. And then when the police started to catch on to that these weren't accidental deaths, or suicide or a heart attack, whatever they thought it was, her reaction was to poison her daughter and then leave a suicide note on her daughter's bed confessing to killing Daddy and David. So, you hear about mothers killing their children. Usually the kids are very small, usually infants. And it's a form of suicide. It's postpartum depression. Here's a woman who has raised this child to the age of 18. The daughter is in her first week of college. And you're going to sacrifice her to save your own butt. And that just flies in the face of everything we think we know about maternal instinct. How could she do that?
Yeah.
And she never, ever, ever admitted to doing it. She died of a heart attack in prison at age 48, denying she'd had anything to do with it, saying, nope, it was my daughter who was the killer. Ashley, the daughter, she wakes up in the emergency room. And there are all these people looking at her. Why did you try to kill yourself? Why did you leave that note? And she's going, I didn't try to kill myself. I didn't leave a note. Last thing I remember, my mom was giving me this foul-tasting drink. So, any question about who was the actual killer went away when a cyber sleuth went into the family computer and found earlier drafts of the suicide note being written at times when Ashley was at school. So it had to be Stacy. It was the mom who did it. And I don't think we're going to see the likes of her again. I just can't imagine a set of circumstances where a desperate woman would sacrifice a child to get out of a jam. It should be the other way around. She should be sacrificing herself to get her daughter out of a jam. And that's the way we think it should be. And yet she was completely opposite.
Yeah, it is amazing. Another amazing case is you have a woman named Denise Amber Lee, a 21-year-old happily married mother of two little boys. Tell us about this bizarre case where she's calling 911 during her abduction.
Yeah, there was a creep named Michael King who was driving around Florida looking for victims. I think he might have had some pedophilia in him. He knew sex workers who were adult women, but who, as part of their act, put up pigtails and tried to, acted like they were young. And he was cruising around and he saw Denise out in front of her house wearing shorts, and she had her two little boys at home, you know, Dad was at work, and he went in, grabbed her, and threw her in the car, took her back to his house, where he had a room set up as sort of a sex dungeon, and he raped her repeatedly, and then put her back in the car, and was taking her to a place where he was going to kill her. Now, Denise was the daughter of a police officer and smart, and she managed to get Michael King's cell phone. She dialed 911, and when the operator came on, by talking to the killer using her own name, mentioning her own address, she communicated to the dispatcher the jam she was in. Now, unfortunately, the dispatcher was at the end of her shift and didn't quite absorb the desperation of the significance of what she was hearing. Kept asking questions, please repeat that. And eventually Michael King realizes that he doesn't have his cell phone. She's talking into it, grabs it away from her, and the call is ended. Now, moments later, there's a woman driving down the highway, and she looks in the car next to her. She thinks there's a child. Denise is a tiny woman. She thinks there's a child in the back seat, obviously in distress, pounding on the window saying, help me, help me, help me. And she calls 911. Gets this same lady who's not even closer to the end of her shift and says, I think there's a child in trouble, and gives in real time, in real space, where she is, where the car is. Car's taking a left. I have to go straight because I'm in the wrong lane. Car's taking a left. Go that way and you'll find it. Well, the dispatcher writes that down and leaves. And by the time the next dispatcher sits down, ready to take calls, reads the note, it's too late. And Denise is found dead in the weeds outside of town. So it's a sad, sad story. The husband, Denise's husband, tried to make a big deal out of it, tried to turn it into a national cause. But I think with good intentions. Let's revamp 911 systems because this can never happen again. And I mean, the problem with that was that most of North America has very, very good 911 systems. I know that if I call 911 here, I'm going to get an ambulance, a cop car, and a fire truck just in case. And it's going to be quick. But, you know, in that particular town in Florida on that particular day, 911 did Denise Amber Lee no good whatsoever.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity, Michael, to stop for a second and talk about our sponsor, which is Rothy's. Have you heard about this company making stylish shoes for women and girls out of recycled plastic water bottles? Oh, and they're crazy comfortable and fully machine washable? Rothy's has quickly grown to a most-loved, gotta-have-them brand. It's no surprise they have over 1,000 nearly perfect reviews. They're stylish, sustainable, comfortable, washable, really all-in-one pair of shoes. They're the perfect flats for life on the go. Rothy's come in an ever-changing array of colors, prints, and patterns, and they're available in a range of styles like sneakers, loafers, points, and more. They launch new colors and patterns every week, and they sell out constantly. My wife, Lisa, ordered a pair of Maritime Navy points. They're called the Point. And she remarked how comfortable they were. And this is a big consideration for her. And she really, these were comfortable shoes. She found them, and I agree, they looked elegant. And when she was very impressed by the shoes, and she's looking forward to ordering something new from Rothy's very, very soon. There's another major bonus. These Rothy's are fully machine washable. Every time they need a refresh, you can simply toss them in the washing machine. It's like getting a fresh pair every day. Check out all the amazing styles available right now at Rothys.com/truemurder. Go to Rothys.com, Rothys.com/truemurder to get your new favorite flats. Comfort, style, and sustainability, these are the shoes you've been waiting for. Head to Rothys.com/truemurder today. Now, Michael, we were talking about Mummy Die, another one of your books. What was one of the most extraordinary things about working on that book, Watch Mummy Die?
Yeah, it's, well, first of all, let me, disclaimer, not my idea for the title. I was going to call it the Monster of the Low Country. Down in the Carolina coast, a fellow named Steven Stanko, who did a 10-year stretch for attempted murder of his girlfriend at the time, my good friend Liz. Hey, Liz, if you're listening. But she survived, and he went away. And while he was in prison, he wrote a book about prison reform. You know, boo-hoo-hoo, it's horrible for prisoners in here. And he got it published. Mm-hmm. So he came out of prison actually having improved himself a little bit. He was a published author, and he was all psyched to write his second book, which was going to be about serial killers. And so all he needed was a branch library with a pretty librarian. He'd be all set. Now, the pretty librarian turned out to be Laura Ling, who became his girlfriend as he did his research. And one, she had a teenage daughter who was also very beautiful. And one night, he went nuts. The pressure cooker blew. And he raped the daughter, slit her throat, and then made her watch as he killed her mother. He then stole her car, drove to a man's house who had befriended him, a fellow named Henry Lee Turner, killed him as well, and then went on the lam in Turner's truck. So he at this point, it becomes truly extraordinary. I don't think since Ted Bundy has there been a guy like this. He is running for his life, and yet he's got time to party, to make friends. He picks up a woman in a bar, and he's getting a new girlfriend already. And he's in Augusta, Georgia, at the time of the Masters golf tournament. And, you know, he's a white guy wearing a golf shirt and some khaki shorts. And his photo is in the newspaper as wanted. It's on the TV as wanted. And he is walking around, and nobody is noticing that this is the guy because he looks just like every other guy who's at the golf tournament. But they eventually catch him. And when they find out his research, the research into this book on serial killers, you know, the sheriff says, I don't think he was researching for a book at all. I think he was trying to learn how to be a serial killer. Which,
wow.
It struck me as pretty interesting because I'm sure that he and I read some of the same books. The only difference was he thought this seemed like a good idea, and I, of course, think that evil should be vanquished. But
yeah.
Other than that, we might have some things in common.
Yeah. Funny. Now, was there anything, Knife in the Heart, your book from 2012, it almost seems not quite as serious as the books preceding and later. Was there anything about Knife in the Heart that was remarkable?
Well, the thing, Knife in the Heart is a social commentary. It's not an examination of evil. These are just kids. It's about a love triangle. Sarah and Rachel both love Josh. And although nobody can really figure out why Josh seems not all that desirable, but they both loved him, and that's all that's important. And they had a feud over him, which he seemed to enjoy. And it was the early days of social media. And I think it was a little bit of warning signal. Because if this had happened 10 years earlier, these girls would have had an argument or a fight, and then they would have been separated, and there would have been a chance for the hostilities to simmer down. But because they had their cell phones with them, they could continue the insults 24 hours a day. And because it's a social media, they were in essence doing it in public. So not only were they insulting each other, they were doing it in front of all their friends. So the person who's being insulted is also being humiliated at the same time. And it builds up to a major fight. And Rachel, who's a cute little blonde, and Sarah, who's a larger woman and a brunette, meet to fight in the middle of the street. And Rachel had brought a kitchen knife with her. And I envision Sarah, you know, putting up her dukes, ready to fight. And Rachel stabs her in the chest with the knife. And Sarah's dead. And just so sad. The other thing that struck me as important in the case, and it's since become big news, but at the time it hadn't even occurred to me, but all these kids were hooked on opioid painkillers. There had been a major theft of a pharmaceutical company down there, and you know, millions of oxycodones went into the high school, and they're all hooked. So their behavior is erratic, even more than, I mean, considering they're teenage, early 20s. You're not expected to act like a full-fledged adult yet. But under the numb conditions that they're in, it's even more erratic. And I ended up befriending, you know, some of the other girls in this group, and I still keep tabs on them. I'm rooting for them. And they seem to be doing okay. They've you know, kicked the habit and are having adult lives now. So that's good. And it's you know, Rachel Wade is the only killer I exchanged letters with who dotted her I's with little hearts.
Oh, incredible. Now, there's a book you call titled Evil Season, and
yes,
a brutal killer named Elton Brutus Murphy. Tell us a little anecdote about Evil Season, if you will.
Sure. Well, I was speaking with a district attorney down there. I was writing one of the other Florida books. It might have been Knife in the Heart. I'm not sure. But I told my 1966 story, as I'm apt to do, and you know, knew these girls that were sexually mutilated. So, oh, well, if you want to write about a sexual mutilation, you should look up Elton Brutus Murphy and talk to him, because he loves talking about him. Now, he was a guy who had all kinds of mental difficulties. He wandered around all day and night picking up garbage, thinking he thought he was an artist and he would make paintings, but they just looked like mud to everybody else. And one day he decides he's got the voices in his brain are telling him to go out and rape a woman. So he's chicken. So he goes into a bar to drink himself into the courage to do it, and goes into an art gallery where a woman named Joyce Wishart is working. She owns the place. And there are pieces of art all over the walls, and they're on the ground, leaning against the wall, and there's somewhere on the floor. And he tries to rape her, and there's only one exit out the front, so he pretty much traps her in there. There's no back exit for her to run to. But he can't accomplish the rape, cannot accomplish the rape, because he spent too much time in the bar. And that's when his knife came out. And he stabs her to death, and then removes her vagina and takes it with him.
Wow.
Now, according to the people who lived with him in his rooming house, that night, for the only time ever, Elton says, "I'm cooking dinner." And he serves his neighbors pork stew, which got mixed reviews. And it seems pretty clear to me. You know, he admits to taking human flesh home with him, admits to chopping it up in little pieces, admits to serving dinner to his neighbors, but denies that those two things are connected. So a lot of times you'll find these guys will admit to everything except for one thing, because if the word gets out about it, they their life in prison could get to be uncomfortable. I know there are lots of guys who will admit to raping adult women who will not admit to raping children, because mm-hmm. child rapists get murdered in prison. But anyway, that's the story there. And it was after, it was near the end of Evil Season, I would say, okay, now I'm ready to go back and write about my own experiences when I was a kid. And as fate would have it, at the same time, my mom and Kathy Bernhardt's mom, the second victim in the Chile murders, are at a party together, sitting in lawn chairs in a backyard. And my mom has a copy of my latest book. She said, my son Michael writes about nasty murders. And everybody's, oh, that's great. I'm so proud of him. And Alice Bernhardt says, it's too bad your Michael can't write a book about my Kathy. My mom said, ask him. I think he'd love to. Well, Alice was too shy to do that. We needed an intermediary, a matchmaker named Evelyn Douglas, who called me up and said, Alice really wants to talk to you, and I know you want to talk to Alice, so why don't you guys get that together? And we did. And Alice says, bring me any paperwork you got. I'll sign it. And I would love to have a book just like the one your mom showed me about Kathy and Georgianne. I said, well, I can't promise a book because that's not up to me, but I can promise I will give you a full investigation. Now that I have next of kin rights, we should be able to get the sheriff to cooperate a little bit, and we'll see what happens. And we recruited Donald Tubman, who is a private investigator who also went to school with the girls. He was graduating from high school on the night of the murders, so he has an alibi. And we went to work, and 4 years passed, and we had developed a suspect that we liked a lot better than Arthur Shawcross. This was a guy who, you know, look at the in-laws before you look at the outlaws. This was a guy, his brother was Georgianne's brother-in-law. He himself was married to Georgianne's first cousin. And I took Alice Bernhardt, who was in her late 80s at the time, and I put her on the 6 o'clock news in Rochester saying something should be done about this. My daughter was forgotten way too soon. If you know anything, tell Michael. Well, I got a series of reports from women in their 50s who were children at the time, all saying the same story. This guy, Clint, and is sometimes alone, sometimes with his brothers, were taking little girls out to Black Creek, putting a knife to their throat, and saying, if you make any sounds, you're dead meat. On the night that Georgianne and Kathy were killed in 1966, there were multiple reports of one loud scream. And Georgianne's throat had been cut so deeply that she was almost beheaded. So I think this is the guy. Tried to get the book published, couldn't do it because it had nothing that the publishers wanted. They like beautiful victims, they like rich victims, they like recent cases, they like cases that you could tie up in a neat bow. And this had none of that. And eventually, The Devil at Genesee Junction was published because I framed my proposal as a personal memoir. But the thing that made this case special was, and it's, you know, My humility makes me hesitant to say this, but the thing that made it special was a guy who grew up to be a true crime writer was a neighbor at the time.
Right.
And Roman and Littlefield published it. They'd never published a true crime book before or since. It's the story of me overcoming childhood trauma by the cathartic use of investigation. But Alice and I knew what it was about. You know, it's dedicated to Alice Bernhardt, and boy, oh boy, did I ever write it for her.
Mm-hmm.
And, she wanted me to do two things, find out what happened to her Kathy, because the crime scene was so ghastly that nobody had ever told her the details, and to get people to think about Kathy, because she'd been forgotten way too soon. So everybody think about Kathy Bernhardt today. It's part of my mission. Both my mom and Alice have since passed away. But, it's a lifetime agreement, my lifetime, not hers. And everybody should read The Devil at Genesee Junction. It is as close as I can come to writing something in my own blood. As I said, I started writing when I was 12. I finished at age 59. And my life changed after that came out. For one thing, you know, that I'm a little bit of a celebrity in Rochester, New York, yeah. And
yeah, great.
which is fun. And I think I did the case justice. But we had hoped that it would be a DNA case because we had a volunteer who was a close relative of our suspect gave us DNA, and we had a cold case officer from the sheriff's department say that they still had the bloody bathing suits in the evidence. I saw, oh, this is great. We're going to solve this. But somehow between that and when the book came out, all of the evidence in the case was lost. We'll put quotations around the word lost.
Yeah.
So I guess we're never going to know for sure. But I've had critics say that the book comes to a satisfying conclusion, and that's good enough for me.
Absolutely. It's an unforgettable case and an unforgettable book. Absolutely. Now, tell us when Escape from Dannemora, and again, I saw the film production of this, I think on HBO, was incredible.
Right.
Escape from Dannemora, one of your books, before we talk about Nightmare in Rochester, again, something that comes, you know, close to home. Tell us about Escape from Dannemora.
Well, I think most people are fairly familiar with the case. It's Richard, Matt, and David Sweat managed to escape from the Clinton Correctional Facility in Dannemora, New York. Not that it did them that much good, but just the fact that they got out was pretty amazing. You had two guys with complementary skills. One was a schmoozer who could make friends easily, got people to do what he wanted. And the other was would have been, if he had had a legit life, would have been a great structural engineer. You know, he could read blueprints upside down from across the room. He could think outside the box. And he was in a box, so that was good. And he found a way to get out of the prison through the catwalks and through the heating pipe, which was only turned off for a couple of months every year, and then eventually out through a manhole into a street in the town of Dannemora. Now, the thing about the prison is it's surrounded by wilderness, miles and miles and miles of hills and valleys and woods and swamps. So it's a little bit like Alcatraz. That, you know, even if you do get out, what are you going to do now? You got to get in a boat and get to the mainland somehow. So these guys had hoped to get a car, and they befriended a civilian employee named Joyce Mitchell, and she agreed to help them, but chickened out at the last second and didn't show up with the getaway car. So they had no choice but to dash into the woods, and for 3 weeks it was the largest manhunt in New York State history, which is saying something. And in the long run, Richard Matt was shot and killed. And 2 days later, David Sweat was shot and wounded and captured again. And Joyce Mitchell did 3 years in prison and just recently got out.
Yeah, it's a very, very exciting book.
Sexual relations with Richard Matt as well.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's another
book that has sex in it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a very, very exciting book. It's now, Nightmare in Rochester, again, there are crimes that occurred when in 1971. And tell us about the writing of Nightmare in Rochester. Again, who do you team up with for this book? And tell us a little bit about it.
All right. When The Devil at Genesee Junction came out, very positive reaction. I had long lines at book signings. And you know, everybody I went to school with was so proud. Everyone wanted a picture. It was really great. And somebody said, what are you going to do for an encore? Well, when I was in high school, this is 5 years after the Genesee Junction murders, there began a series of murders of little girls in the city of Rochester, Carmen Colon, Wanda Walkowitz, and Michelle Maenza. And they were all abducted. They're 10, 11 years old. All abducted, walking alone on the street in the inner city of Rochester, and found in a rural area outside the city, dumped beside the road. And it seemed like it might have all been the work of one guy. First one was a little bit different from the second and third. Second and third were identical. They're the same guy. Whether or not the first one's by the same guy, we don't know. But there was, 2 years after it began, there was an article in the Rochester Democrat Chronicle, an interview with a psychiatrist from the University of Rochester, who said he had it all figured out. The killer was a mastermind. And these killings that looked spontaneous and opportunistic were actually well thought out in advance. And that all three victims, of course, had the same first and last initial, and that all three had been dumped in a town that also began with that initial. Now, there's a leap of logic there, that because these girls had the same first and last initial, that's the reason they were chosen as victims. But everybody immediately embraced it and believed it. You know, there are still people who are absolutely convinced that this guy must have known these girls in advance, because he chose only girls with the same first and last initial to investigate the case. I was thinking about this, and it kind of didn't make any sense. And what are we supposed to believe? This guy's cruising around the inner city of Rochester looking for little girls by themselves. Is he asking them their names? And if their names don't have the same first and last initial, is he rejecting them and then continuing his search? Because there weren't any little girls saying that they'd been asked their names by strangers.
Yeah.
So I went into the theory, okay, it's a coincidence. And the geography part, that didn't work out at all, because Carmen Colon was not dumped in either Chilai or Churchville. It was in a different town with a different letter. Michelle Maenza was technically in Macedon, but it was right on the town line with Walworth, and absolutely no way for the killer to know which town that was. It's just a cornfield. So I went under the assumption that it was all coincidence, and what we had here was just a guy driving around. He knew what he liked, like 10, 11-year-old girls, and if they were, he did it always after school but before dinner, when you're most apt to find little girls walking alone, and three times he was successful. Now, there were certain number of suspects that came up who lived in the town of Gates at that time, which is the town next to Chilai. And the crimes in terms of disposal greatly resembled those of the Hillside Stranglers, which he became one of. And he had shown that although he preferred adult women, he wasn't adverse to raping and killing a child. Two of the Hillside Strangler victims were children. I don't think many people know that. But he, of course, denies that he had anything to do with it. The thing I should note is that it could be a DNA case. There is extant DNA from the Wanda Walkowitz crime scene. There was DNA evidence from the other two as well, but it was used up at the time for a secretion test, which was the state of the art at the time. Instead of just using a portion of the sample, they used the whole thing, never thinking that 50 years, this could be really valuable. Then there's Joseph Nazzo, who grew up in Rochester, married a Rochester girl. His wife grew up across the street from my dad. And he went to California and became a serial killer and killed a series of sex workers, many of whom had the same first and last initial, including another Carmen Colon, which was the name of the first victim in Rochester. How could
Incredible.
That be a coincidence? Yeah. But you try to look into that, and there's evidence that Joseph never knew the adult Carmen Colon's name, that she wouldn't have given him her real name. And he kept lots of notes, copious notes on all of his crimes dating back to when he was a teenager. And he mentions how good their legs are. He was a photographer. He took photos of women both alive and dead. There would be comments about the photos he took, the dates, the places. Never once did he ever mention that he had anything for the alphabet. So, okay. The third suspect I looked at was a guy named Dennis Termini. And there are still cops in Rochester who are convinced Termini must be the guy. He was a serial rapist. As far as we know, he only raped adult women. But the thing that tied all three double initials cases together was that there were white animal hairs found at all of the crime scenes. And Dennis Termini's car had cat hairs in it. And he killed himself after being caught mid-rape. And so he could not be questioned.
Mm-hmm.
And his DNA, as all, you know, no DNA has ever matched the Wanda Walkowitz DNA. Now, the last one, the guy I found, is named Ted Given. Now, if we assume that the initials don't mean anything, that what we're looking for is a guy who cruises around looking to pick up little girls, Ted Given's the guy. In 1974, he abducts two little girls in the town of Gates and takes them to an abandoned house, ties one up in the basement, and attempts to rape the other one upstairs. And when he's done, he then puts them back in the car, takes them back to the park where he found them, and lets them go. And the police chief at the time of the town was asked by a reporter, "Do you think you have the double initial guy?" And he goes, no, can't be. These girls had different first and last initials.
Oh, Jesus.
So I started another pen pal situation with Ted. And Ted said, you keep calling the guy I said, you have some things in common with the double initial killer. So I would like you to be an expert witness for me. Give me an idea of how this guy ticks. What makes him tick? And he said, well, first of all, the name of the guy is the alphabet killer, not the double initial killer. Get it right. And I probably shouldn't talk to you at all, but I've been looking at myself in the mirror a lot lately, and I've decided it's time to come to grips with some things. So right there, I thought it was a little bit, he was leaning on an admission, but he didn't quite get there, and never did, by the way. But he told me in really gruesome detail how he became a pedophile, and we had all kinds of insights into how pedophiles think. Again, I think that the chances that all four of these guys are completely innocent in the Nightmare in Rochester cases, it seems remote. And there's absolutely no reason to think that this is a lone nut. Pedophiles have clubs. We've seen it in the past. There was Breckenridge up in Vermont, a group of guys who used computers to share, kiddie porn pictures. They find each other and facilitate each other's, weird needs. So, I mean, it's entirely possible that what we're seeing is a tip of an iceberg, much of which we haven't yet found. And eventually we're going to find one of these guys, and he is going to be a match for the Wanda Walkowitz scene.
Yeah. Incredible. Now tell us about Haunting Homicides and why the title. This is 2019.
Well, Haunting Homicides was originally going to be called Cold Case Rochester. And these were going to be cases that we encountered while Don Tubman and I, that we found while we were investigating the Devil at Genesee Junction and Nightmare in Rochester. And, a lot of things seem to be connected into that were not, hadn't been published. So I put them together and formed a kind of a magazine, a true crime magazine of cases. We changed the name from Cold Case Rochester to Haunting Homicides because by the time we were done, they weren't all cold cases. Some of them had been solved, and now all of them took place in Rochester, although they had Rochester connections. So haunting, and they're all haunting, that was for sure. So that became the title.
What were some of the cases that were especially haunting?
Well, I'd like to think they're all equally haunting, but there are a couple of cases that there has been activity in since the book came out, which is kind of exciting. There's a case of Joanne Lynn. She was an 11-year-old girl who looked older, and in September 1949, her school bus broke down, so she had to walk to school, and she never made it. And then a few days later, her body was found 7 miles to the north, hidden underneath some trees, and she'd been raped and murdered. And glory be to the Livingston County Sheriff. They kept that evidence, and it is still good. There's a DNA profile. I mean, from 1949, there's a DNA profile. Unbelievable. But while I was doing research, I found that they used bloodhounds in an attempt to figure out what happened. And the bloodhounds went down the road where she was walking and got to a particular farmhouse, which was known as Green Acres for some reason. And the dogs went one at a time, but they both did the same thing. They, alongside the house, behind the house, milled around behind the house, then came back to the shoulder and stopped end of trail. So the sheriff says, this must be where the motorist picked up the girl. And I said, wait a second. Those dogs went behind the house. They both went behind the house. So we took a closer look at the house. And we found out that living there at the time was a middle-aged man who had been kicked out of the house by his wife for trying some funny business with her stepdaughter, who was a child.
Right.
And he was living with his sister and with a 16-year-old boy who didn't seem to be related to them in any way. And he was a key witness in the initial investigation because he said he was the only one who said he heard a scream. And after he heard the scream, he went to the windows on both sides of his house and did not see a car leave. Later on, Don Tubman's find, he went down into the basement of a retired cop and went through dusty boxes and found a letter that had been written to the Rochester police chief in 1949 by a woman who worked with the 16-year-old kid's mom. And she was complaining that she couldn't get in touch with him ever since the murder. And that one time she called him and he answered the phone, he hung up in the middle of a sentence, which made her think that somebody was hanging up the phone for him. So we have new suspects in the case. And we've located the adult man's grave, in case there's any disinterring that needs to be done. Because I don't mind digging up the dead if it's going to solve a crime.
Yeah, well, what this change in your career, or this is, oh, I'm going to say change. I would say evolution in your career in terms of being an investigative journalist and author, but the teaming up with Donald Tubman, it seems that maybe I'm wrong, but it's a new direction in terms of in investigation, in terms of what an author normally doesn't do. It relies on police reports. You do an investigation of sorts, but is this a new direction, an evolution in your writing? It seems to be even more satisfying than the writing of your other books for me. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think what it is I finally made it to where I wanted to be in the first place. You know, the initial idea was to figure out who killed Kathy and Georgianne. And in order to get there, I had to write for a big-time publisher who always demanded that a jury had convicted a person before we ever wrote about them. So there was investigation to do, but there was no, I wasn't breaking cases in any way. And since we had so much success with the Devil at Genesee Junction, I really do think we figured out what happened. I couldn't stop. I'm always going to be looking at whodunits now. And that's, you know, if somebody pays me to write another book like Evil Season or The Burn Farm, where the killer's already in prison at the time I start, that's fine. But it's not as fun as taking away a question mark and putting a face in its place.
Absolutely. I could really, really sense that with these last few books. How about Carmine the Snake, your collaborations, and in 2020, Lord High Executioner with Frank DiMatteo? Just tell us a little bit about this collaboration with Frank.
Well, Frank is the son of a gangster. His dad was Larry Gallo's bodyguard, one of the President Street Boys. Larry Gallo was Joey Gallo's brother, who was famously whacked in Umberto's Clam House. Frank has made a living out of the cards he was dealt. He has a magazine called Mob Candy, and he wrote a book, an autobiography called Lion in the Basement, because Joey Gallo kept a mountain lion in the basement of the social club, and if somebody owed him money, they just took him down the stairs and showed him the lion, and the guy would pay up. The lion never actually had to kill anybody.
Luckily.
Because Frank, dropped out of school after fifth grade or whatever, because it was cut into his hanging out on street corners time, he's not an extremely literate guy, but he's smart and he's a reader. But the resulting book was somewhat endearing but comically flawed. There are a lot of D's and those and this and that. And I was given an assignment to take his self-published book and to transform it into something that could be published by Kensington Books. And it became Growing Up Mafia, the President Street Boys, of which I was an editor and he was the author. And after that, we said, well, this team works pretty good. He's got all the street cred. I can write sentences with proper grammar. And we took on the biography of Carmine Persico, who was a longtime head of one of the five families.
Mm-hmm.
Here in New York. And after we did that, which did very well, we took on the story of Albert Anastasia, who was the head of Murder, Inc., and later became a godfather himself, and was famously whacked by Carmine Persico in a barber chair in the Sheraton Hotel in Manhattan. So it's been fun. It sounds perhaps a little cold, but because these are stories about guys who are kill or be killed, there's not the sadness and there's not the heaviness that weighs on my brain that there is when I'm writing about cases where there's a stark contrast between good and evil. This is more like war stories. And I've been finding it the fun for the first time in many years to write again, because usually some sort of the demon within me that makes me do this stuff, and it's not that much fun. But telling mafia stories can be kind of a riot.
What do you do to counter this darkness that you have to always delve into constantly?
Well, I personally do not have a dark side. So when I'm not working, I try not to dwell. I like to go to baseball games, and I have a lovely wife. I have two grown kids who are perfect in every way. Life is good. But it's always good for me when I am writing a particularly tough book to have something I can turn to. Like during the time when I was writing the Devil at Genesee Junction and Nightmare in Rochester, I also wrote Why the Grateful Dead Matter.
Right.
And perhaps there's no better way to alleviate yourself of too much time on the dark side than to listen to some Grateful Dead. It's very relaxing.
Sure. Absolutely. Now, for the audience that's craving more Michael Benson, Is there something that you're working on now, considering now, looking into, delving into? What might the audience be looking for next?
Well, I have a couple of things in the works. There's a third Mafia book with Frank I'm working on. It's called Mafia Hitman, about a fellow named Carmine DiBiase, a.k.a. Sonny Pinto. And he's the actual killer of Joey Gallo. And the reason that it's coming up now is because of the movie The Irishman, in which Frank Sheeran takes credit for killing Joey. And I can guarantee you there was not a single Irishman in the room at the time when it happened. And on the other side, there's more Rochester cases coming. And I don't want to get too specific just yet.
Yeah.
But the Rochester bookstore should be aware that I'm coming up for a book signing sometime before the year's out, and it's going to be great.
Fantastic.
I haven't come up with a title yet, but these are murder cases that took place very close to Genesee Junction.
Wow.
Geographically, it's been a real draw for evil. As you know, the name of Devil of Genesee Junction would imply. It's kind of true. We've got throughout history, going back to the real olden times, it's a good place to kill people and stash bodies.
Yeah, you've said it's a rich territory for a true crime writer, and certainly it's that's evident.
Yes. Yeah. I think there's something in the water.
Well, lucky for us.
That's why we only drink Genesee beer, because that's good for
us. Yeah, absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Michael, for coming on.
Oh, Dan, thank you.
Being part of this. For those that might want to take a look, can they go to an Amazon page, website? Tell us how people might take a look.
You have an Amazon page to myself. Put Michael Benson, True Crime, and it comes up. I have a white beard. The guy who takes pictures of planets, he's
a different
guy. You'll be able to figure it out. Keep watching the Investigation Discovery Channel, and I'm usually on about once a day. I was on 2020 last Friday night, although I have to admit I missed it. I started getting texts, and by the time I turned it on, it was almost over. But that was the Stacey Castor case.
It'll be on again and
Mommy
again.
Mommy Deadliest.
I'm certain.
It'll be on again, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Michael. This has been fantastic. A Michael Benson True Crime Retrospective. Thank you very much, Michael.
Best podcast in the world.
Thank you very much, Michael. You have a great evening.
You too.
Good
take
night.
Take care. Bye-bye.